Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Pennsylvania is one of many state and local governments to legislate new rules and laws for police departments to adhere to in the aftermath of George Floyd's death while in Minneapolis police custody last month. Floyd's death has resulted in nationwide protests and calls for racial justice and equality. The Pennsylvania House and Senate have each passed separate bills that include requiring employment background checks on those looking to become a police officer or join another department and also improve training. Also, a two-year grand jury report found there were systematic failures on the part of Pennsylvania regulators, including the Department of Environmental Protection, to guard against the negative health effects of fracking at natural gas drilling sites. Finally, asking Congress for $1.5 billion in anticipation of an increased number of child abuse investigations after the COVID-19 pandemic. These are all topics we'll discuss with our guest today, Pennsylvania's Attorney General Josh Shapiro. Attorney General Shapiro, welcome to the program.
Good morning. Good to be with you, and I hope you and yours are safe and healthy.
So far, in my basement, I'm doing okay.
You sound great in your basement.
If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Attorney General Shapiro, I want to talk about the police reforms in just a moment, but yesterday you outlined the findings of a two-year grand jury that are very significant and actually history-making, I would describe them as, that state regulators didn't guard against fracking used in natural gas drilling, polluting and causing bad health effects for people living near the drilling sites. What agencies and what did the grand jury find they did or didn't do?
Well, look, the bedrock principle here that the people of Pennsylvania can rely on and that forms the foundation of all the work we do to protect people's public health and protect our environment is Article 1, Section 27 of the Pennsylvania Constitution, which literally reads that the people have a right to clean air and pure water, and it goes on. And then there's other statutes as well. We have had a two-year grand jury investigation into the fracking industry. Over the last 2 weeks, we charged two fracking companies with crimes. One of them has already pled. And yesterday, we released a report detailing how the regulators, and not just over the last few weeks or months or a year, but over the last more than a decade, have failed to deliver on that constitutional right to the people of Pennsylvania. Specifically, we focused a lot of attention on the Department of Environmental Protection, who I believe are, and the grand jurors believe, and it is clearly documented, that they're too cozy with industry. But look, the people of Pennsylvania have a right to know that the regulators are going to set the rules for industry and enforce the rules. And time again, they failed to deliver on that requirement, that commitment to the people of Pennsylvania. This isn't subjective. This isn't, you know, an issue whether you're for fracking or against fracking. This is the basic rules of the road, right? Industry answers to shareholders. They're trying to focus on their bottom line. And we have government to make sure that we set the rules and enforce the rules. And over more than a decade, DEP failed in its mission to protect our environment in Pennsylvania. And they failed to protect the people of Pennsylvania, plain and simple. And so the grand jurors, in a long document, after hearing 287 hours of expert testimony, wrote a report that not only documents that failure, but recommended 8 specific things that the government needs to do, either by executive action or by legislating, in order to best protect the people of Pennsylvania.
When you say too cozy with the industry, give me some examples of what the grand jury found. What do they mean, too cozy? Did they look the other way when they knew there were violations, or just what?
Let me give you an example from the grand jury report. And I'm obviously limited in what I can talk about to the four corners of the report. I can't go beyond that. And I've already said many times that there is going to be more to come beyond the two criminal charges or the two companies we've charged and beyond this report. So I'm going to be limited in what I can say. But here's an example from the report. You know, a, a Pennsylvanian living in the rural part of our state saw a spill into a waterway, saw the water in that waterway get polluted, change colors, and they called the regulator, as you're supposed to do. And logic would dictate that the regulator would come out, right, take some water samples, determine what happened, and if, in fact, the spill occurred and the water was polluted, as it clearly was, take action, whether it's issuing a fine or referring something to my office for a criminal prosecution. Instead, they contacted industry, asked industry what happened, and when they got a satisfactory answer from industry, they actually called the Pennsylvanian back and said, if you go forward, we'll prosecute you for filing a false report. Wow. That's the kind of cozy relationship. And there's so many other examples. You know, I talked about what the grand jurors found in their report, you know, sort of this revolving door between some at DEP who would work as regulators and then immediately go work for industry right after at presumably, you know, inflated salaries beyond what they were making as government officials. The relationship is simply too darn cozy, and it needs to change. Now, the Wolf administration has made some changes, and the grand jurors and I applauded them for that. But a lot more needs to be done, and that's why we put forth these recommendations. And these recommendations, I think, need to be considered quickly and addressed by the lawmakers and passed.
And we'll talk about some of those recommendations in just a moment. But you mentioned that there was too cozy of a relationship. One thing that we have heard from DEP, maybe during the entire time that natural gas drilling, the Marcellus Shale, has been going on here in Pennsylvania, is that they don't have enough resources. Inspectors in particular, that they don't have enough people. Their budget isn't big enough. Does that contribute to any of this?
Well, look, you know, the grand jurors are and I are not in a position to evaluate, those issues. The governor, I know, in his budget has asked for more resources. If you're asking me my personal opinion, yeah, I think that we need to fund DEP in a way that allows them to have enough personnel to do this job. But I would also say, you know, before you write them a check, you got to pass these reforms and you got to make sure that you have personnel there who are not going to be cozy with industry, who are actually going to be on the side of the people of Pennsylvania, to ensure that the constitutional right we all share to clean air and pure water isn't aspirational, but is something that is actually occurring day in and day out.
You mentioned that two companies, your office has prosecuted two companies recently. In this grand jury report, do you believe, does the grand jury believe that there was anything criminal?
Okay, let's unpack what you just said, because I want to be very, very specific in what I say. The grand jury conducted a long 2-year investigation and found many things. I've only made public some of that at this point. What we have made public are essentially three things. Number one, criminal charges against Range Resources, a fracking company, to which they've already pled guilty. They've already pled. Second, criminal charges against Cabot, another fracking company, which they are fighting. And third, this grand jury report. They wrote this grand jury report because they saw troubling patterns. They saw things that they wanted to make sure regulators and the public were aware of. And they saw areas where recommendations would ultimately help achieve the goal, help achieve the requirement that Pennsylvanians have clean air and pure water. Those are the only three things that that we've announced thus far.
So you're not confirming or denying that there could be criminal charges?
I have already said that there would be more criminal charges coming. You asked me a question about what we've done so far, and that is what we've done to this point.
Okay. Why a grand jury? I mean, I was curious about this as to, I mean, obviously You're the state's top law enforcement officer. Law is not just criminal. But why is a grand jury, why was there a grand jury used to investigate this and the Attorney General's office? Is it because of that constitutional amendment in Pennsylvania's Constitution?
We received a criminal referral from a local district attorney, and we acted on it. This is more than 2 years ago at this point. And we opened up a grand jury investigation. And through that, we have, you know, uncovered the things that I've announced already and more. And that is why we engage in that type of criminal investigation. Now, I've also been engaged in civil matters to hold the fracking industry accountable. For example, up in northeastern and north central Pennsylvania, fracking companies came into landowners and said, we want to pay you X amount in order to be able to drill on your lands. That X amount is called royalties. And yet they stopped paying those landowners royalties years ago. We sued them. And in that case, that's not a criminal action. That's a civil action. And what we're trying to do is recover the money that is owed by this fracking company, these two fracking companies, to the landowners. So, you know, this is not the only work we're doing in that area. And to your point, there can be a criminal investigation, as we're talking about here this morning, and there can also be civil matters that we're engaged in, and we do both.
You know, I go back to something you said a little bit earlier, that this is not a pro-fracking or an anti-fracking report. But, you know, over the years, it's kind of been laid out that way. And I'm not talking when I say it's been laid out, that there seems to be very little gray area when you're talking about this. There are people who think this is such a huge job creator. Pennsylvania is the second leading natural gas producer in the country. It's created tens of thousands of jobs. It's been held up as a way that Pennsylvania's economy has thrived. And then there are the people who say that, you know, that this is unhealthy and that, you know, just as the grand jury report laid out, it's causing some ill health effects. So all those things taken into consideration, how could it not be looked at as pro or anti-fracking?
Look, at this point, I can tell you that this isn't about if we should allow fracking in Pennsylvania. It's about how we expect fracking companies to act and how we expect state regulators to respond. Here's the deal. Look, businesses are motivated by profit. But the government has to be motivated by our duty to protect the health and safety of all Pennsylvanians and to protect our environment under the Environmental Rights Amendment in our Constitution. And DEP's job, and frankly, the responsibility of the General Assembly, to make sure that fracking activity isn't allowed to be dangerous and isn't irresponsible. And what I said yesterday when we released this grand jury report is that we've clearly fallen short of that responsibility. And whether you're in favor of fracking or not, you know, to follow up on the manner in which you asked that question, I think everyone should be opposed to fracking that's done dangerously and irresponsibly, and everyone should be in favor of laws and regulations that better protect Pennsylvanians from the reality of this heavy industrial industry and the risks that go along with its operations. And that's why the grand jury recommendations are so important, because they will advance public interest by protecting the public, both the public health and our, you know, public spaces, and they'll improve industry oversight. And it's hard for me to imagine who would be against that. This is something we should all want, whether you're for fracking or against fracking.
Those recommendations, there were eight of them that the grand jury made. I'm not going to go through all eight of them, but of the recommendations made, which ones do you see are the most important and that the legislature should take up?
Look, obviously, you should expect me to say they're all important, and they are. Let's take one, for example. You know, we had story after story where parents were waking up in the middle of the night with kids who were having their nose bleeds, or their noses were bleeding. People who were getting sores, who every time they showered were coughing and getting marks all over their body. Clearly, there is some issue with their water. And one of the reforms that the grand jurors called for is that there should be public disclosure of the chemicals that the fracking industry is using to drill these wells and to extract the natural gas. Pretty darn common sense. We even had one example in the grand jury report where a parent took their kid to the doctor, and the doctor said, look, I'm sorry, but I don't even know, I'm paraphrasing, I don't even know what to test for because I don't know what chemicals your kid has been exposed to. And so the grand jurors thought that we ought to disclose what chemicals the fracking industry is using. And the reason we don't is because they hide behind some bogus argument that it's trade secrets. And guess what? DEP, in their legal filing to the grand jury report, which they were permitted to do, and there's an unedited version of what DEP wrote. You can go read it for yourself on our website. They actually came out against that. DEP, the regulators. Mm. It's actually something Governor Wolf has said he's for.
Department of Health.
And I got to tell you, the idea that the regulator would say we don't want the public to know what chemicals are in their water, what chemicals are impacting their health, that to me is reckless. That to me demonstrates even further the cozy relationship that they have, and it is simply wrong. It needs to change. And that's why the grand jurors recommended that.
So you're saying that DEP now, during the Wolf administration, responded that way?
Yeah, you can go read their filing.
I just wanted to make sure.
The way our grand jury laws work, and we strictly adhere to them, is when a report like this is written, we give it to the parties that are named. So in this case, you know, DEP would be a party name. And we give them the right to go and respond as they see fit. And we don't edit that. It just gets attached to the report. And then the judge authorizes the release. So that's their running. And by the way, we also gave DEP unprecedented access to the grand jury. We said, you can come in, you can present whatever you want. You can educate us the grand jurors, about whatever it is that you want to educate us about. And they failed to take advantage of that. Now, Dr. Levine from the Department of Health, she did come in. And I would say the Department of Health did a very good job. And we complimented them and commended them for what they did. In contrast to that, DEP didn't participate in a meaningful way and instead wrote a document that seems to be parroting back the talking points of the industry and furthermore opposes the recommendations put forth by the grand jurors.
Mm. So much to talk about, and we have links on our website, WITF.org, to the report and also our news coverage from WITF. We're going to talk about police reforms in just a moment. You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Our guest during this portion of the program is Pennsylvania's Attorney General Josh Shapiro. Attorney General Shapiro, obviously police reform has been something that has not just been at the top of a list of priorities for the Pennsylvania legislature, but Congress, also some local jurisdictions as well. Two bills passed, one in the Senate, one in the House. They have to be reconciled, but just let me hit some of the highlights here. Departments would have a written use of force policy, making public and train officers on it, while banning those use of force policies, including chokeholds. House approved a bill to require police departments to conduct background checks of job applicants that require an applicant's former department to disclose information on the officer's job history. Other bill approved by the House requires officers to train every other year in how to interact with people of different racial and ethnic backgrounds. Also requires officers to undergo a mental health evaluation for post-traumatic stress disorder within 30 days of an incident in which the officer used lethal force. Your thoughts on the reforms that are in the legislature right now?
Look, I think it is clear we need to build trust through listening to all of our communities in Pennsylvania. And we need to ask people and listen to the righteous voices that are peacefully protesting and others who are advocating for reform and say, what do you think will make you feel safer? And then we need to act constructively. We're beyond the point of just tweet about things. We actually need to do some things that are constructive. And so I formed a coalition of law enforcement leaders, the Legislative Black Caucus, and reform advocates, and tried to find some common ground so we could advance these reforms. And by the way, this didn't just happen in the last week couple weeks since the killing of George Floyd. This dates back to a private meeting I called back in October of 2019, when I brought together leaders of law enforcement, leaders of the Legislative Black Caucus, and said, let's find some common ground. Let's talk to one another. And much to my surprise, they had never met before. They had never had a conversation before. And from that discussion, what became clear is that neither side wanted to have, quote unquote, bad police officers. And so we began to work together on ideas that would allow us to root out those police officers who shouldn't be on the beat, and instead make sure that we could improve the integrity and the competency of police departments. One of the ways we thought we could do that is by creating a statewide database for police complaints and misconduct that would travel with that officer when they're trying to go from police department A to police department B. After the killing of George Floyd, those talks really ramped up, and I went to both sides and said, look, now is our moment. We have got to do something meaningful and respond to these voices. And we were able to take that coalition from an idea to a bill to ultimately passage of that database bill by, I believe, a unanimous vote in the House this week, and I understand it'll be taken up by the Senate shortly. That's the kind of meaningful change that we need, and I think it's a down payment on the kind of progress we need to make around police reform, something I'm very committed to and something that I think is necessary here in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania.
You know, that is unique in that almost any other job in which someone is applying for a position, you can get information on their background. Now, granted, there's some things you can't say for privacy reasons, but one of the unique aspects are that larger police departments are represented by unions that have opposed some of these proposals, including that work history. Will that be an issue here?
Again, we want to make sure that officers who engage in misconduct or use excessive force and erode the trust in law enforcement, make it harder for our communities to feel safe, can't just simply be passed from department to department. And so having this database available to the police chief or the township manager or the mayor, whoever's making those hiring decisions, is going to be empowering for a community so that they know that the officials making that call to hire Officer A or Officer B, that they're in a position to know the full history of that police officer and hire people that have good track records and can be a good fit for that community.
But at the same time, I want to get back to what I said about the unions. I mean, Philadelphia, Pittsburgh, some of the larger cities have unions. This has been a real issue. Has there been any indication that those unions are willing to adopt this?
Yeah, take a look at the coalition I built to support this bill. It includes the Pennsylvania State Troopers Association, a huge police union. It includes the state FOP, the State Fraternal Order of Police. It includes FOP Lodge 5, the largest local lodge in our state. They're based in Philadelphia. All the major police unions are on board because they recognize that they don't want bad police officers in their ranks. And I think that it is critically important to acknowledge that fact, that we have those police unions on board and that they want to see this change. In addition to them, our coalition includes the chiefs of police of the three largest cities in Pennsylvania, Allentown, Pittsburgh, and Philadelphia. It includes the Chiefs of Police Association, which represents municipalities all across the state. It includes the Pennsylvania District Attorneys Association. It includes the district attorneys from, your listening area, including, Center and Dauphin and Franklin and Lancaster and many others. So it is a broad coalition of law enforcement who has said enough is enough. We want to make sure that good police officers are being hired in our communities and bad police officers can't simply be passed from one jurisdiction to the other without people knowing their full history.
Should that database be public?
Right now, the legislature has written it in a way that it is available and mandated to be checked by the people making the hiring decisions, right? As I said before, whether it's the township supervisor, the police chief, or whomever. As to whether or not it should be public or it should be right to knowable, things like that, all of those are going to be issues that the legislature works through. My focus has been on making sure that we have integrity in our hiring process. And we built this coalition, again, a broad coalition of law enforcement, Legislative Black Caucus, reform advocates, in order to make sure that we can have this integrity and confidence in our policing.
I know you have a limited amount of time, Mr. Attorney General, so one final question on a different issue.
Sure.
You and the District Attorney Association looking for $1.5 billion annually from Congress tied to child abuse. What is that money needed for?
Look, anyone listening knows that, you know, the protection of children has been a central focus of our work as Attorney General, from the groundbreaking grand jury report into the abuse of thousands of children by predator priests in Pennsylvania, the cover-up there, to the arrest of police chiefs and public officials who are abusing and exploiting children. We take this very, very seriously. A big way we're able to track down child abuse is through something called Childline. That's one resource we have, where tips about abuse come in. And here's the thing. Tips typically come from mandated reporters, like a coach or a teacher, a bus driver. In fact, 84% of the tips come from those mandated reporters. Since the governor shuttered schools in order to deal with the pandemic, which obviously was the right call, tips to Childline are down more than 50% because those mandated reporters simply aren't around children right now and won't be, obviously, during the summer. And we'll see what happens in the fall. We know that children are still being abused. It's not as though, abuse is down 50%. And so what we're trying to do is say, look, let's get counselors and others out into the community and meet children where they are now, so that we can ensure their safety. And the $1.5 billion, which would obviously be a national figure, not just a state figure, is something the district attorneys and I and Senator Casey are working on so that we can fund these counselors to get out and best protect children. I do want people to recognize that if you look historically at moments in time where you have serious crises, particularly serious economic crises, which put more stress on families, abuse of children sadly goes up. We saw this after the Great Recession in 2008. With about a million Pennsylvanians out of work, about a third of our workforce since the coronavirus pandemic began, it's not a stretch to imagine the financial stress in people's homes has led to more abuse. Yet because our mandated reporters aren't seeing these children every day and the calls to Childline are way down, we're really worried that we're not able to identify who these kids are being abused, which makes it harder for law enforcement then to go and identify the perpetrators and the criminals. And so we really need these resources to help identify who the people are who are victimizing and abusing these children. And let me tell you something, as my record is clear, when we find them, we will arrest them, and we will enforce the law to the fullest extent and make sure that those who harm a kid are behind bars for quite some time.
Attorney General Josh Shapiro, thank you very much for being with us today.
You're very welcome. Thanks for having me, and stay safe.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. Coming up on Monday's program, we're going to be talking about, defunding state police. Really hasn't been a whole lot of serious discussion about defunding state police in particular, although defunding police or moving funding around for police departments has been a big part of the discussion over the past month. But we'll be talking about how Pennsylvania has a unique situation, and we'll be talking about funding with state police. Also, the enduring legacy of President Andrew Johnson and racial inequality. That's coming up on Monday's program, so be sure to tune in. As you just heard Attorney General Josh Shapiro say, child abuse reports are down about 50% since the COVID-19 pandemic began in March. That's when Pennsylvania schools closed and children weren't being seen by teachers who were mandatory reporters of suspected abuse. So what happens when students return to school this fall, if indeed that does happen, and what happens in the meantime. Joining us is Angela Little, President and CEO of the Pennsylvania Family Support Alliance. Angela Little, always good to talk to you.
Good morning, Scott.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. You can leave a question or comment on WITF's Facebook page. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Angela, I don't know whether you got to hear the last answer from Attorney General Shapiro, but I'm sure you're well aware of all those statistics. So what is going on right now when it comes to child abuse, child neglect, while everyone is at home, not going to school, mandatory reporters not seeing these kids? What's going on?
Well, I think, first of all, Attorney General Shapiro was spot on. I did hear his comments. I think he's been just a tireless advocate for the protection of children. And those of us working in the field of prevention and child welfare are huge fans and support of his leadership. He is correct. Numbers are down. With that, though, I would say that when we look at some of the state data in April and May, for instance, when people in schools were seeing children on virtual platforms as their only means of interaction, there were still nearly 1,000 reports from school personnel made to Childline. So that tells you that there is good reason to be concerned about children who are now not being seen by mandated reporters and are spending large amounts of time at home with parents who either have a history of abusive tendencies or who are just completely overwhelmed by all of the stress factors brought on of the past several months. So I think there are several good things going on to address that. One is groups like ours, Pennsylvania Family Support Alliance, are doing trainings that are tailored to folks who only see children on a virtual platform. So giving them tips and things to look out for, policies that they should maybe consider, because let's be honest, that's the highway. You know, the internet is the highway for child predators to get to children. And sometimes, unfortunately, they even work in our school system and our children and youth serving agencies. So we're doing trainings on that. In case schools don't go back in session brick and mortar, we would encourage more and more school personnel to be involved in trainings like this. That information can be sought at pa-fsa.org. I think another thing that's good, and it kind of goes along with what the Attorney General was saying, Scott, is some pending legislation, House Bill 1910, Dan Williams' bill, actually puts training requirements in place as we're looking at what do we need to revamp with law enforcement and their preparedness and their training. You know, for many, many years, Pennsylvania Family Support Alliance has been training the state police cadets on how to recognize child abuse and how to properly report it. But they didn't have a requirement for that. So they did that because they believed that was important. We obviously commend that. But there's pending legislation now that would put training requirements in place for magisterial district judges and police officers. That's a good step as well.
I'm curious. You said that there have been 1,000 reports to Childline of teachers or educators who have seen students, virtually. And this training that you're talking about, tips of what to look for. I'm curious, what are some of those tips for mandatory reporters to be looking for?
Yeah, well, some of those would be, now understand that still is a reduction in reporting from school personnel.
Understood.
But we were still surprised. I mean, it was a little under 1,000, but we were still surprised to see that many, which told us there were some pretty strong concerns. It could be something the child said to the teacher. It could be something they heard in the background. It could have been a child, believe it or not, left home alone unattended. Or other children in the home. It could have been something related to you know, food insecurity, whatever the reasons. You know, so that's some of the things that we train on what to look for. Be aware of what you see in the surroundings behind the children. Be aware of additional things that you hear aside from just what a child is saying. Some of the things we really encourage is consider building in safeguards. For instance, it's a great thing to go ahead and record Zoom platform meetings. It's a great thing to always have two adults on those virtual sessions or when there is any kind of electronic communication. They're good policies to have in place. Again, we're not always very good at holding people accountable and responsible, but this is something where you don't want to leave open the possibility again for, you know, if you have a bad apple in the bunch, to have access to kids without there being monitoring from the organization or the school.
An issue that I know that your organization addresses on your website, I've seen it, I think we've even talked about it before, but that is the age, the maturity level of a child staying home by themselves. Let's face it, with this pandemic, there were a lot of people that didn't have access to childcare, had to continue to work, and there may be some people, I'm sure there are, that left their kids home by themselves without a babysitter or someone, an adult, to watch over them. What age is an appropriate age, or how is that decided when a child is mature enough to be able to be home by themselves?
Well, here's the interesting thing. Most people believe there's a minimum age in Pennsylvania, and in fact, by law, there is not. So we encourage parents to do some test cases. First, you always want to make sure that children know not to ever answer the door or the telephone if they have a cell phone. So the question would be, if you left the house and said, I'm running down to the gas station on the corner, don't answer the door. I'll be back in 15 minutes. You go outside, you wait 5 minutes, you ring the doorbell and see if the child answers the door. If they do, they failed that test. They should not be left home alone. You have to go over all the safety measures. You know, do they know about calling 911? Do they know the exit to the house and the steps to take if there were to be a fire? Is there a neighbor or someone close by? And then you have some of those other issues. Are there any, you know, special circumstances, a child perhaps with a physical or an intellectual disability that impacts it? What are the time frames that the parent would be gone? There are many, many factors to consider, and it's really important for parents to put a lot of thought into that. You are spot on, Scott, that this is a very serious concern. Let's be honest, these are frightening times for parents. Many do have to work. They don't have access to child care. What do they do? It's very concerning.
Taking a step back, Angela, I have to admit, and it's just a personal thing, that the reports of child abuse or neglect, by the way, are these reports, when I say neglect, are what does it all include to Childline? Abuse, what else?
Well, I'm just looking at it in terms of calls.
Okay.
Childline.
All right.
So it could be sexual abuse, physical abuse. It could be neglect. It could be, you know, yeah. It could
okay.
be any of those. Yeah.
What I was going to say is that just a personal observation. I have to admit, I thought 50% was higher than what I would have expected. You and I talked when this first started, and I know that we're very concerned that we wouldn't be getting very many reports at all. So 50% sounds a little bit high to me.
Yeah. You know, we've tried to do a lot of work with our friends and supporters in the media, and I know the Pennsylvania Department of Human Services has as well. Because let's face it, when children are not being seen by mandated reporters, the next group that you really have to focus on are the community members. We cannot stress enough on any given day, regardless of a pandemic, how important it is for community members to be aware of the children in their midst. Again, our fallback statement always is, I don't think it'll ever change, everyone has a role to play in protecting kids. So there's been a lot of messaging pointing out to folks, if you believe that there's a child in your neighborhood or on your street that you know of, by all means, report. Anyone can make a report. So there's been a lot of effort put into that.
And, you know, it's all probably a good time. What is that child line number if someone is witnessing something that they may suspect there's some child abuse going on?
It's 1-800-932-0313. We should also mention, Scott, not related to the pandemic, but every year the Department of Human Services releases an annual report on child abuse in Pennsylvania to the General Assembly and the public. That was released in the last week or so for the year 2019. And, you know, I think many of us have become a little numb with statistics and data and numbers, especially when we see them climb or the, you know, double-digit numbers or of the coronavirus. But in 2019, we had 51 children killed as a result of child abuse. And that's an increase from the year before that. So, again, very concerning. It's certainly not in the thousands. But when you think about the fact that, again, this is something that is avoidable, this is truly a societal health issue, but it is avoidable and preventable. And so that's a concern for us. And the other concern is, you know, the classification of near fatalities. Again, we had 93 near fatalities. That's an increase above 2018. And again, the concern on that is at least half of those are neglect. That means children were not supervised properly, and they ingested perhaps over-the-counter or prescription drugs or illegal drugs. They were not fed, those types of things. Very concerning for us.
Mm. You know, I echo what you were saying, Angela, and I try to mention this often when we're talking about numbers, but, you know, and especially in a case like this, when we're talking about some of the most vulnerable people in our society, children, mm-hmm. that these are not numbers. Yes, they're numbers. Those are numbers mm-hmm. to provide some context mm-hmm. on what you're talking about. But at the same time, there is a human being tied to every single one of those numbers. Because I do think you're right when you say that sometimes, you know, we just hear the statistics and it becomes a number, and that we don't put the human face and the human feelings and all that to it. So encourage people to think of it that way. What about this year? I know you don't have statistics from the Department of Human Services for this year, but have you heard anecdotes of children maybe who have lost their lives or near fatal cases going on this year during the pandemic?
Oh, sure. That's something that, you know, we had just a couple weeks ago in Adams County. I'm just thinking of what comes to mind most recently. There was a 15-month-old child, a toddler, who was shaken and killed. So, you know, as Attorney General said, there are a lot of stressors right now. And sometimes the strongest parents who have been very loving and good moms and dads break under the kind of stress and pressure. And so this is a key opportunity, Scott. We have to remind neighbors. We have to remember grandparents, grandmas, grandpas, aunts, uncles. Do your part, even if you don't live by locally, even if you're concerned about social distancing. Make sure you lay eyes on these kids. You know, if that's FaceTime, if that's Zoom, whatever you need to do. And then it's a time where you have to put down the judgments, right? This is a time where if you're a parent, if you're a caregiver and you're raising children, then, you know, it's okay to ask for help, whatever that may be. And if you're in a position to lend a hand and give some help, by all means, cast no judgment right now. Because if this situation the past several months have done anything, it should have made all of us a little more humble. And as you said, these are our little ones. They're children that have bright futures ahead of them, that have a lot of love in their heart and strong spirits. but they deserve to be cared for and valued and believed. And we all have to do our part to help lift everybody up right now.
Attorney General Shapiro talked about using $1.5 billion annually. Now, that's a national figure, but obviously it would mean millions of dollars to Pennsylvania. But he was talking about going out, and I think specifically during the pandemic, but going out since there are so many kids that are not being seen by mandatory reporters, teachers, educators today. What would that look like? What does going out mean in investigating these cases or looking at suspected child abuse?
Well, you know, the child welfare system has never closed down during this time. And that was, you know, a fallacy that some people believed. In fact, you know, these great professionals who risk their lives every day, even during the pandemic, continued to go out and investigate reports of suspected abuse. So they did their jobs. They continue to do their jobs. It takes a lot of money to do that. And we know the financial concerns facing Pennsylvania and every other state right now, right? We're looking at a six-month budget. There's lots of concerns about funding child welfare services. It's expensive, but it's something we've got to do, and we have to continue to reevaluate our commitment and make sure the money goes along with our words of our value system.
How's it different, though, during the pandemic as far as going out and investigating cases? I mean, are you still relying on calls to Childline, or, you know, is there anything different during the pandemic?
I don't think so. We have to remember that the child welfare system is one that is largely reactionary. So they don't just randomly go out and check on children unless they receive a report that either a mandated reporter or a member of the community called a permissive reporter has concerns. And then they follow up. So I think how it was made even more difficult for them during this time, there's some concern about county child welfare staff not being classified as essential. I know there were challenges then related to that in them having an adequate number of PPEs. In fact, I know that many private citizens, my household included, sewing machines were going, making masks and taking them to some county offices for use. At one point, they put out an appeal for needing 3,000. So it's frightening, but their jobs are frightening every day of the year. These folks go into homes where police go who are armed.
Angela, I want to take a step back for a second. There were some counties where child welfare workers were not considered essential?
I believe every single county office. That's something that has to be legislatively directed, that has to be, you know, addressed. And so that made getting some of the PPEs needed a bit more challenging. Yes?
So were there people who were furloughed or laid off?
I am not aware that that was the case at all. Again, they have to report and they have to respond to reports with investigations. So folks were doing that. Obviously, some staff were working remotely during the shutdown. Some of the visits that they could do virtually, they were doing, but certainly not investigations. They were actually having to go out and, you know, see children and ensure that they were safe and, you know, cared for.
Mm. Angela Little, we're almost out of time. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. That Childline number one more time.
1-800-932-0313. And for training on child abuse recognition and reporting, PAFSA.org.
Angela Little is the president and CEO of the Pennsylvania Family Support Alliance. Angela, always good to talk to you. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you so much, Scott. Take good care.
Coming up on Monday's program, we'll be talking about funding of state police and the enduring legacy of President Andrew Johnson and racial inequality. That's coming up on Monday's program. Have a good weekend. I'll see you on Monday morning.